Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of protest and the subsequent massacre of Palestinian civilians by Israeli soldiers. James S. Henry of Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, who examines the purpose and use of the multi-million dollar slush fund controlled by President Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen. And activists speaking at a rally against the incarceration of women and girls at Connecticut's York Prison, who are challenging the nation's money bail system that discriminates against the poor. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A decade ago, during a peak in Colombia's 50-year civil war, the army lured young men into the city of Ocaña, 400 miles from the capital city of Bogota. According to the Guardian newspaper, once there, the young men were killed by soldiers and declared rebel fighters in order to boost the headcount of the number of leftist insurgents killed. The murdered civilians, often referred to as false positives, were in fact executed to boost U.S. military aid to Colombia. Many army officers involved in the killings were promoted to higher ranks. According to the Guardian newspaper, a new report co-authored by a retired Colombian police officer claims that 10,000 civilians were victims of false positive killings between 2002 and 2010, more than triple the number of murders earlier estimated by human rights groups. Even as Colombia's largest rebel army, the Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, laid down their arms in a peace deal in 2017, false positive killings are still occurring. Colombia President Juan Manuel Santos, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the peace deal with FARC, was Minister of Defense from 2006 to 2009 at the height of the false positives killings. Human rights activists complain that neither Santos, former President Alvaro Uribe, or any Colombian general has yet been convicted for their role in these war crimes. Kentucky, a red state that embraced Obamacare, is changing course under Republican Governor Matt Bevin. The Bluegrass state is set to be the first in the U.S. to enforce work and community engagement requirements for some Medicaid recipients. Critics condemn the move, embraced by the Trump administration, for taking away health insurance from tens of thousands of low-income people. They note that the majority of Medicaid expansion enrollees in Kentucky are already employed, mostly in low-wage jobs. They argue that requiring people to work won't mean there will be employers that will hire them. To remain eligible, able-bodied working-age adults without dependents in Kentucky will have to work at least 20 hours a week, be a full-time student, or complete a number of other community engagement activities ranging from job searches and vocational training to community and caregiving service. Not meeting one of those criteria would lock people out of coverage for 6 months. Health advocacy groups have sued the state, asserting that the program violates the Social Security Act. During a rally of affordable housing activists on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, a white counter-protester, Sonia Traus, a leader in the Bay Area Yimbyism movement, Yes in My Backyard, moved through the crowd and got involved in a confrontation with veteran activists from the city's communities of color. Traus, whose efforts are funded by Silicon Valley executives like Yelp's CEO Jeremy Stoppelman, is a star among free market advocates seeking to build new housing in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. Young YIMBY members attend planning board meetings and have launched lawsuits against California cities and towns to overturn housing restrictions. According to In These Times, YIMBYism has taken off during the recent housing crisis, where it is common for 40% of an individual's income to be spent on rent or mortgage payments in urban neighborhoods plagued by gentrification. Racial tensions have spiked as Traus has compared Latino anti-gentrification activists to Trump supporters who oppose immigration. Housing activists like Maria Zamudio of the Plaza 16 Coalition see YIMBY activists as a front group for developers, landlords, and speculators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The study and contrast between the horrific violence on the Israel-Gaza border and the posh celebration of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem on May 14th couldn't have been more stark. As an estimated 50,000 Palestinians gathered along the frontier fence line in the sixth straight week of protests, Israeli army snipers opened fire, killing 58 people and injuring 2,700 more. This was the deadliest day since the Great March of Return protests began on March 30th, that are demanding an end to the 12-year Gaza blockade and the right to return to land now occupied by Israel. Since these protests began, at least 107 Palestinians have died, including children and journalists, and 12,000 others have been injured. While Israel justified the slaughter, asserting that protesters who attempted to damage or break through the border fence presented a threat to Israeli security, nations across the world have condemned Israel's use of excessive and disproportionate force. The deadly demonstrations coincided with the opening of the controversial new U.S. Jerusalem embassy on the 70th anniversary of Israel's founding, and on the eve of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, May 15th, when Palestinians commemorate the date when 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled or fled from their homes during the 1948 Palestine War. Your reporter spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who talks about the desperation of the people in Gaza, which led to 6 weeks of militant protests and the subsequent massacre of civilians by Israeli soldiers at the Gaza-Israel border.
People in Gaza are basically imprisoned by Israel. It's not so much a border as it is a prison, in that people in Gaza can't get in and get out for the most part. Even on the Egyptian side, when outsiders try to get in to break that blockade, people have tried to get ships in there to try to give some breathing room to the over 1 million people repressed in Gaza. The Israelis intercepted, occasionally killing people who try to do that. So the circumstance in Gaza is dire constantly, and I think that that's part of the reason that you have people who are fundamentally saying, give me liberty or give me death. That's what these Palestinians are saying, that their lives have become so oppressive by what Israel has done for generations that they are willing to, you know, take these drastic actions that may well result in them being killed.
Sam, I did want to ask you about Israel's statements over these past 6 weeks, and certainly today, justifying live sniper fire on what have been reported to be mostly or pretty much entirely unarmed civilians in a protest there at the border. Israel claims that the threat presented by these protesters, many of whom approach the border fence and some attempting to damage or cut through the border fence, was justification for the live sniper fire that has killed so many over the past 6 weeks.
I think that it violates the incredible number of legal precepts and ethical precepts. These people are only doing it because they're desperate and see no other recourse, because the international community has done virtually nothing for them, even though Israel has had them in this imprisoned situation for years and years. I heard the U.S. ambassador earlier today saying that they burn tires and, you know, they have kites. The Palestinians burn tires to prevent the view of the snipers so that the Israelis will have a little bit of a rougher time shooting and killing them. They are not a military or meaningful threat. They are, in a sense, a symbolic threat to the notion of an Israel that continuously oppresses. And what they're saying is, you've got us in this pen, and you've prevented us from going to our homelands, and you'll shoot us if we try to, and you've made our lives so miserable here that we almost don't care anymore. We're just going to go to our homelands, and, you know, you shoot us, you shoot us. You know, as if Native Americans on the Trail of Tears, you know, decided to turn around and go back to their, to the homes that they were being forced from, and the U.S. military was shooting at them. You know, if that were to happen, Hollywood would make a very sympathetic movie about that.
Sam, with Trump's recent moves to relocate the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and full bore support for expansion of Israeli settlements, it seems that any pretense of negotiations in the near future for a two-state solution is flat off the table. What does the future hold, given this powder keg that we've seen explode here on the Israel-Gaza border? What's next?
I think the so-called two-state solution, the U.S. as some kind of honest broker, has been a bit of a, something of a fantasy for some years now. And I think now it's gone beyond fantasy to, you know, an utter depraved joke. I was never a key signatory to it, but the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel has really been a grassroots movement that has genuinely put some pressure on Israel. And I really take my hat off to a lot of the activists who led the way on that. That's something that's very tangible that people can do and they can plug into. And it's not just, you know, rhetoric. And I think that you're needing to see meaningful activism in countries like the United States, as well as new leadership emerging among Palestinian ranks in order to reassert their fundamental rights, because it literally is, you know, a matter of life and death for them, or perpetual servitude.
That was Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Find more news and commentary on the desperate conditions in Gaza and Israel's deadly attack on the Palestinian border protest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Trump-Russia investigation rolls on, much of it behind closed doors, new revelations made headlines when Michael Avenatti, adult film star Stormy Daniels' attorney, disclosed that several major U.S.-based and international corporations had made large payments to Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Avenatti is challenging the validity of the non-disclosure agreement that Daniels signed just before the 2016 presidential election, requiring her not to discuss an alleged affair she had with Trump in 2011. Avenatti released a report, much of it now verified, which stated that Michael Cohen's company, Essential Consultants, received $600,000 from AT&T, $1.2 million from pharmaceutical giant Novartis, $150,000 from Korea Aerospace, and $500,000 from Columbus Nova, an investment firm linked with Russian oligarch Viktor Vekselberg. These funds were deposited in the same LLC account from which Cohen paid Daniels $130,000 in hush money in October 2016. It's notable that all these companies that gave Cohen money had important business issues awaiting decisions from the U.S. federal government. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment, a global justice fellow at Yale University, and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics. Here he examines the purpose and use of the multi-million-dollar slush fund that Michael Cohen controlled and the legality of corporate money flowing directly or indirectly to a president through a third party in order to gain influence.
I suspect that in this case, this may well be something that Trump had no knowledge of, that Cohen was looking for, you know, kind of a freelancing opportunity to sell access to the president. And he talked these companies into this proposition on the basis of, you know, every one of them that was involved here. We know certainly AT&T with its, you know, Time Warner deal, Novartis with drug regulations, and, you know, they were firms that really needed to have an inside track on government regulation. You know, this wasn't a whole lot of money for them in the aggregate compared to the potential value of having access to the president. But, you know, the Times had a detailed profile of Cohen in which they went into many of his other dodgy connections going back in time, and his uncle involved with the Lucchese mob and operating El Caribe, a place in kind of a watering hole from a mafiosa. And Michael maintained an investment in that club until 2016 after the election. The more interesting and I think important relationship here was the Vexelberg relationship. Viktor Vexelberg is one of the richest people in Russia. He has intimate relationships with many of the other GARCs that have come up in this kind of last 2 years in the story, in the investigation, people like Deripaska. Leo Blavatnik is a Russian-American who made a lot of donations to, you know, $6.3 million of political contributions to U.S. politicians in the 2016 election cycle. He's Vexelberg's partner and has been an investor with Deripaska, who's implicated in the Michael Flynn matter and the Manafort investigation. So this is a kind of a tiny, very influential crowd that, you know, some say have been basically deployed to gain influence over the Trump administration. And so this is kind of consistent with my favorite theory about what's been going on, which is not so much that Trump is a kind of a mole on the part of Putin. There is a whole investigation of collusion that Mueller is doing. But I'm just more struck by this kind of long history of kind of mobster activity. I mean, it's kind of organized crime has had a long-term relationship with Trump and with some of the people around him.
For myself and our audience, I'd like you to discuss a bit about the money that was coming into Michael Cohen's LLC from large corporations like AT&T and Novartis. Michael Cohen, as I understand it, was not a registered lobbyist. So what's the legality of hundreds of thousands of dollars and even over $1 million that was pumped into that account by some of these corporations? Is this a legal transaction to buy access to the president, or at least what they thought was buying access?
Clearly, if Trump had known about Michael Cohen's fundraising activities here and had sent him out to shake down these companies in exchange for access, that would have been, I think, over the line. But where you have a case here that the companies are kind of responding to Michael's invitations, they're hiring him, you know, for alleged consulting services. You know, I think that, you know, there's an argument that the president didn't even know about it. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but, you know, we have to benefit of the doubt. So I think in this case, what we have is foolhardy behavior. It certainly has, you know, impropriety written all over it. It's the avoiding, in terms of avoiding the appearance of impropriety. But it may be a case of where it's hard to prove that there was any kind of real exchange for services. In fact, just the opposite. These companies have come away with their kind of black eyes as a result of this. And it's not clear that he ever delivered anything. We may be on the verge of learning much more about a whole web of relationships that Michael Cohen was involved with. There was this strange meeting at the Trump Tower in December 2016 in which one of the senior investors from Qatar met with Michael Flynn and with Trump and also with Rick Perry, the Department of Energy cabinet executive in the U.S., and who knows what they were discussing, but the meeting happened just a couple days after this deal in which Qatar invested in the big Russian state-owned company Rosneft and basically helped to buy a transaction that involved about 20% of Rosneft. There are all kinds of allegations in the Steele memorandum for those of you know who are really down in the weeds here on the Trump investigation. That transaction with the Qataris featured prominently, and there we have basically Cohen holding hands with all these people during this kind of very dubious meeting that day. So I suspect that we're going to find out much more about people that he maybe recruited, that he tried to recruit. But, you know, this is a fellow who's been deeply involved in the Trump administration for at least a decade and probably longer. And, there's probably more to come out about him.
That was James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and senior editor at DC Report for Investigative Economics.
Find links to articles examining Trump-era pay-to-play schemes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut was one of many states and cities around the U.S. that raised money and awareness to bail women out of jails and prisons for Mother's Day this year. The Connecticut Bail Fund, working with a dozen other groups, raised about $30,000 and bailed out 30 women. The funds were used to bail out 26 women from the state's only women's prison, York Correctional Institute in Niantic, with another four bailed out from immigration jail. While these women are charged with crimes, they haven't been convicted and are incarcerated only because they can't afford to pay bail. The groups participating in the Mother's Day bailout, as it's called, are not simply raising money to release women from jail, but are challenging the entire money bail system, which discriminates against the poor, the population most frequently caught up in the criminal justice system. On May 8th, the coalition of groups taking part in the Mother's Day bailout held a rally in a park adjacent to the York Women's Prison, where advocates, including many formerly incarcerated women, shouted their encouragement to the women still behind bars. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and brings us excerpts of several of those who spoke.
Ana Maria Rivera Forestieri works at the Connecticut Bail Fund.
There's nearly 1,000 women that are currently incarcerated in this cage, in this state-sponsored cage, that are not going to be able to go home to their loved ones. And so throughout the last couple of months, through the work that we've been doing, and through the stories that some of which you're going to be hearing about today, we've been learning about the human rights abuses that women are experiencing inside this facility. And so we want to stand in love and solidarity, but we also want to shed light into what's happening right here in Connecticut. Some of the abuses that women are experiencing, from sexual harassment to sexual abuse to medical neglect, from immigration agents coming into this facility impersonating lawyers and tricking people. We want to let people know what's happening inside this facility. And we want to send a message of love and solidarity that we're here, that we love you, that we stand with you, that we're going to fight every single day until all of you come home to your communities.
Yes. Woo!
Repeat after me. It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and protect each other.
We must love and protect each other.
We have nothing to lose but our change.
Tahiba Bain yelled to the women inside York about a new state law to protect their rights.
I'm here today because I want to let the women at York know that for anyone that's in there that is pregnant, you have the right today to not be shackled during transportation. Woo! Throughout this past session of the legislation, we have been successful in passing Senate Bill 13 for an act of fair treatment for incarcerated women. You are now allowed and supposed to be provided sanitary napkins free of charge. The people that are pregnant, you're not supposed to be handcuffed, shackled during labor and after delivery. So know your rights, ladies. You have that right and you have to fight for your right. I was in York CI many, many years ago, maybe 3 or 4 times. So today I want to let you know that even though you're behind that wall today, you can be out here tomorrow doing the same thing. And don't forget about the sisters that you leave when you do leave, because they're going to need your help like you need our help today.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down, down with incarceration.
Up, up with liberation, down with incarceration.
Hi, my name is Nicole Kennedy. I was just released by the Bail Committee Fund on Friday.
Yeah.
praise dance in order to raise money to bring women home. You would have not told me I would be one of those women. Today, amen. I stand here and I say I'm free. Praise the Lord, I'm free. No more bounds, no more chains holding me. My soul is resting. It's a blessing. I'm free today to fight for other women that was in there with me, sat with me. 7 days in a medical lockup. You go nowhere for 7 days. Your mental state of mind goes through torment. You don't know when you're getting out. You are a victim of the state. Today, my fear is, I went to court today, and my fear was they could revoke my bond if they feel like it and place me back in for heartaches of 3 years ago. My past is my past. Judge me for my present, because my past, I can't live by that anymore. You tell me to change, you tell me to rehabilitate, then leave my past in my past and judge me for my presence. And that's why my presence is out here, to tell those ladies that watch me leave Friday, I am out here still fighting to get the rest of you out. I will not sit still, and I will not be quiet anymore like I was told in those walls. I was told when to speak, when not to speak. And if I spoke, I was told to shut up. I had no value. I had no opinion. I had no say-so. Today, I got a lot to say. You will not treat us the way you have anymore. We have rights. We have the right to fight for what we believe in, and we believe in that these walls will no longer hold us back. I'm going forward to say thank you to this committee and these people that are out here rallying. Thank you for freeing me. You came and got me, so I need to come back and get the rest of them. Ladies, let's do this.
That was Anna Maria Forasteri, co-director of the Connecticut Bail Fund, Teheba Bain and Nicole Kennedy, speaking at a rally in solidarity with incarcerated women at Connecticut's York Correctional Institute on May 8th. Learn more about groups challenging the nation's money bail system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.